Stories that you need to know about on this day. Only CNN would do something like this. They actually called on an Israeli to describe what the people in Iran are thinking. And they called it journalism. Donald Trump pulls a Hillary and he laughs at the dead. It's not a good look, but we're going to let you see it for yourself. And one of the world's leading scientists on missile defense is going to join me to show and tell and explain who and why and where these Iranian missiles are eluding U.S. interceptors. How is that happening? This is the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, I don't even know where to begin with how fundamentally dishonest the U.S. media has become. Yeah, it hurts because I used to work there, right? In particular at CNN. Yeah, because I used to work there and because they are fundamentally honest these days. Listen to this. They're doing a story, right, on how Iranians inside of Iran are reacting to this war. It's a good story. I would watch. So you'd think that they would talk to people inside of Iran about how they're feeling, right? Or maybe if they can't go inside of Iran, I get it. Maybe you could talk to an Iranian who just left Iran, right? And if you can't get an Iranian who just left Iran, maybe you get somebody even from the diaspora, though most of them haven't seen Iran in 47 years, but at least you're a little closer to it, right? No. They interview this woman that I'm about to show you. Her name is Emily Schrader. And listen, to what she says. Watch.
By and large, the responses from Iranians that I've spoken to has been overwhelmingly in favor of the United States and Israeli action on the ground. The united call from the Iranian people on the ground is that they want the Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi to lead a transition government.
She basically is saying the people in Iran love the people who are bombing them, love the fact that they're being bombed by the United States. And by the way, let me tell you who this woman is, this Ms. Schrader. So she is a Jewish American person from Seattle, Washington, who's now living in Israel. Her husband is in the IDF, and she runs a public relations company, a PR company to promote Israel that is funded by Miriam Adelson. Can you believe that? This is who CNN calls on to find out what's happening inside Iran. And by the way, she has a right to have an opinion about what's going on inside Iran. I don't deny her that. But shouldn't CNN tell us who this woman is? Other than just throwing some woman on the air and saying, we're going to learn from her what the people of Iran are thinking. This is crazy. And they call this crap journalism at CNN. This is why the American people don't know a damn thing unless they watch alternative media. And you notice how she pushes this narrative, how everybody in Iran is just waiting for the Shah's son to come back and take over the country. The Shah's son. Even Trump, who, by the way, you got to give credit to Trump. His first instinct on things is usually very good. Then somehow something happens. But his first instinct is usually really good. And when he heard about this idea that this woman just proposed here about the Shah's son going back there, he thought it was a stupid idea. Take a listen.
I guess he is. Some people like him, and we haven't been thinking about too much about that. It would seem to me that somebody from within might maybe would be more appropriate. I've said that. He looks like a very nice person. But it would seem to me that somebody that's there, that's currently popular, if there's such a person. But we have people like that. We have people that were more moderate.
Yeah, maybe somebody inside of Iran should be running Iran, not a guy who left half a century ago. See, Trump has good instincts about stuff like this. The problem with Trump, though, is then money comes in, favors, neocons. They come along and, you know, we call that in Spanish, radio bimba. You know, they start getting in your head. They start talking to you. Suddenly, he changes his mind. One minute, I got to end the Ukraine war. The next thing, well, maybe, you know, whatever. Blaming Putin. So who would want to change Trump's mind about having the Shah's son go back in power? Let's see. Who has the power? Who has the money? Who has the influence? Who wants the Shah's son to run Iran? I got some video to share with you. Take a look at this. I found this video from about 2 years ago. Look who that is. It's the Shah's son. Look where he is. He is in Israel, being courted by Israelis. There he is, Reza Pahlavi, being welcomed and saluted at Israel's Western Wall, where he's recognized as Iran's crown prince, he's called. The guy hasn't been there in almost 50 years, and he's the crown prince of Iran. Actually, he lives in L.A., and they refer to him that way. By the way, why did Iranians kick his father out of power? That's an important question to ask now, right? Because I asked myself that this morning as I was looking at this video. So I just did a simple Google search just to find out who was this guy, the Shah of Iran, right? Back in the 1950s or whenever he was there, 1953, I guess, when Mossadegh was taken out. Well, here's what I found out. In Iran, under the Shah, political parties were mostly banned or tightly controlled. Elections were seen as meaningless. This is who they want to put back. And the government ruled through fear and enforcers with an organization called the SAVAK. It was an intelligence service that was created by the CIA and the Mossad. Now, this is open information. You could go Google this yourself right now and you'll see the same thing. And what did the SAVAK do? They spied on dissidents, they arrested people without trials, and they tortured and executed their enemies. Sounds like the perfect country, the perfect government that the people of Iran are now crying for, right? I don't think so, but I continue. So now, Mr. Trump, he probably doesn't know much about this history that we just read together, because that would require reading, which is not something that he really does a lot of. But what Trump does seem to revel in these days is the power of being in charge of a war. I mean, there have been some videos that have been put out lately that make you go, wow, a little cringe-y, you know? He talks about death and destruction, and he almost seems to be enjoying it a little too much. Watch this video he just put out.
The Navy is gone. It's all lying at the bottom of the ocean. 46 ships. Can you believe it? In fact, I got a little upset with our people. I said, what quality of ship? Excellent, sir. Top of the line. I said, why did we just capture the ship? We could have used it. Why did we sink them? They said, it's more fun to sink them. I said, that's a... They like sinking them better. They say it's safer to sink them. I guess it's probably true. Their terrorist leaders are gone. We're counting down the minutes until they will be gone. Think of it. We had leaders, and they're gone. Then we had new leaders, and they're gone. And now nobody has any idea who the people are that are going to be the head of the country.
You can't believe in God and say things like that. Look, I understand anger and I understand vengeance. Somebody kills my kids or my wife. Yeah, my instinct is going to be I want them dead, right? I mean, I get it. Even though I happen to believe in a God who told me that I need to turn the other cheek. But killing 100 sailors on a ship that's 2,000 miles away with a torpedo from a submarine, 2,000 miles away from the war, these people were. They were helping the Indian Army. And then laughing about it and telling jokes about these people, describing how they drowned and then they sunk to the bottom of the sea. I don't know. You know, I can think of one other person or one other case that I remember of someone in this kind of position, like the president, laughing and enjoying death so much. Do you remember when Libya's Muammar Gaddafi was tortured by an enraged crowd? They literally sodomized the guy to death with a pipe while he was still alive. Hillary Clinton thought it was friggin' hilarious.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
The point I'm trying to make is it's unbecoming, you know? The death of a human being is not a joke. Whether you like them or not is immaterial. But that kind of thinking that people need to just be eliminated, vanquished, incinerated. Where does that come from? Well, there was a guy who was talking in those terms recently, Bibi Netanyahu. He says it in Hebrew. He's been careful not to say this in English. But listen to how he explains why all Palestinians need to be eliminated. And he says it by comparing them to the Amaleks, which is, by the way, in the Old Testament.
I draw immense strength from the steadfastness of our citizens and the heroism of our soldiers and commanders. We read in this week's Torah portion, remember what Amalek did to you. We remember, and we are taking action.
Yeah, remember the Amalek. We remember. And he suggested now we act, right? That's what he's saying. There's no denying what he's saying, what he's doing. What he's suggesting is what he's doing to the Palestinians, what was done to Amalek. Same thing. Because I guess it's what God wants, right? In fact, here's the passage that he's, it's from 1 Samuel in the Old Testament. It says, "Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." What's he saying? Kill the children, kill the pets, kill the women, kill them all. 14,000 children are dead in Gaza. 14,000. And 53,000 have been left without either a mom or a dad or both, orphaned. 53,000. Sounds like they're a new Amalek, right? Slay both man and woman, infant, suckling, right? Ox, sheep, camel, ass. Kill them all. This isn't about saying that wars are not on rare occasions necessary. That's not what I'm saying. I get it. Hitler needed to be stopped, and so have others in history. But killing your enemy's children? Killing their children? Laughing or bragging about the death of human beings because they happen to be born in another country? Those could have been American sailors. They just happened to be born in Iran. That's kind of wrong. No, it is wrong, and it's sick. And it's why a lot of Americans, many Americans who fought and served for noble causes, are not buying this war. Colonel Doug McGregor says there is nothing noble about this, for example.
Netanyahu's delusions of dominating the whole region and demonstrating Jewish supremacy there and worldwide are now Trump's reality. He seems to be committed to that, regardless of the cost to us, regardless of the cost to the world. The longer this lasts, the worse the picture gets globally. I think the Iranians have decided that rather than live on their knees, they're going to stand up even if it kills them. I think the Iranians have made it very clear that they will not meet Mr. Netanyahu's demands. So we have to understand that the demands President Trump stipulated are not our demands. They're Israel's demands as articulated by Mr. Netanyahu. And what is Mr. Netanyahu's view of the world? The world is a place that Jews must dominate, at least insofar as we're talking about the Middle East. But I think what we are doing is that this is the last act in the American theatrical production in the Middle East. When this ends, we will be finished in the Middle East. There will be no restoration of the status quo ante. We will simply get out. And everybody in the Middle East will want us out. I mean, if you're living in the Gulf right now, what have we demonstrated? We can't protect them.
Right.
Our deterrence has failed. So what good are we to them?
Doug McGregor. Listen to those words again that he said. Let me read them to you because I wrote them down here. The Iranians have decided that rather than live on their knees, they're going to stand up even if it kills them. Well, so far, I just checked a little while ago. The number may have gone up again. 1,300 Iranian civilians have already been killed from the bombing of residential areas in Iran. And that's according to the country's officials there, as well as several news organizations that have been quoting that number. That's about 1,000 more, by the way, than most people think Hamas killed on October 7th. And that's according to most experts. They're standing up. And in fact, I think we should say that they're kind of standing up in a surprisingly effective way, which yesterday, I don't know, I interviewed a Saudi guest on here on the show yesterday who, interestingly enough, said he's angry at Iran for fighting back, which I thought was interesting, if nothing else noteworthy. He's angry that Iran is successfully striking the U.S.'s oil installations in the Gulf because he says those installations are like his country, Saudi Arabia, for example. I was struck by that response, so I had to come back and ask him then. So I don't understand. What are they supposed to do if they're being attacked by the U.S. and Israel? Listen, let me ask you just a like a basic question that a 10-year-old would ask. If I'm being attacked and I have no other recourse to attack my enemy other than to hit his resources, which are happen to be in what I consider to be my backyard, what else am I going to do? What else could Iran have done to punish the United States for punishing them?
Yeah.
I don't
it's
know.
It's actually what interesting else? Because, yeah, I see your point, but the idea that you have I would call it the green light to target 12 countries just to punish the global economy so you can punish the United States, that shows that this behavior is very counterproductive and it will get the countries to be in the same page with the United States to fight you.
So let's move now beyond the morality of war, the consequences and the politics of war, and talk about something more measurable. Let's talk about the X's and O's. So once again, I'm drawn to this video that I showed you the other day, which really caught my attention. Look at that. This is an Iranian missile literally evading U.S. interceptors. See the two interceptors coming at it right there? There's the Iranian missile. It's trying to target it. Instead, they crash into each other, and there's the Iranian missile continuing on its path. It's almost like it did a loop-de-loop. It's almost like a magic missile, like the old magic bullet theory on the JFK assassination. This is a fascinating piece of video, and it stayed with me, right? So we were sold this idea as we watched this right here, stories of the Iron Dome and the impenetrable anti-ballistic systems like the THAAD and the Patriot that exist out there. In fact, these systems were sold to countries all over the world, South Korea, Japan, and others, and they were told that nobody will now be able to attack you as long as you have this special pill, this special missile that we're selling you for billions of dollars. But now we're seeing these missiles at work, and they don't work so good, right? They don't work so well. So what are these countries going to do? Did they spend billions of dollars for something that doesn't work? They send them back? It's like going to Walmart? And by the way, I mean, as I look at these pictures, I'm left with the idea of what message does this now send to the United States' allies and everybody else out there? And like Colonel said, is it making the countries in the Gulf scratch their heads and go, whoa, maybe we're on the wrong side here? Joining us now to talk about all of this is one of the world's foremost experts on ballistic missiles. Ted Postal is a professor emeritus of science and technology and international security at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Fantastic facility, beautiful facility too, by the way. He's also worked at the Pentagon, the Argonne National Library, and at Stanford University. Professor, I'm so glad you're here. I've been watching you all over the place explaining this, and I just think you're so smart. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not so sure I'm glad I'm here because of the reason.
Yeah.
So it's nice talking to you, but the reason for being here is unfortunate.
You have one of those jobs where people only call on you when there's bad news. It's like being a cop, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, all of a sudden, I'm a person of interest.
Person of interest. Well said. Hey, let's start with the videos. I put together about 9 videos I want to take you through. And the first one that I want to show you is the one that I just shared with my viewers. This is the very first one that caught my attention because it almost looks, here you've got the two interceptors, or what I describe interceptors. Please correct me. I am not an expert. You are. That seem to be approaching this missile, Iranian missile. It almost looks like the missile stops, lets them crash into each other, and then it continues on its way. What's going on here? Explain this to us.
Well, what's going on is that the radar on the ground, those missiles are Patriots. They're not Iron Dome. So they're a bigger, much more expensive interceptor. Those cost about $4 million each.
Mm.
And the radar is not quite tracking the incoming ballistic missile accurately enough. And when the Patriots get close enough to try to acquire the incoming ballistic missile, they are too far away to do the final maneuver to have any chance of hitting them. And incidentally, I have videos from the Gulf War of 1991 that show exactly, I want to underscore, exactly this kind of engagement. So from 1991 to today, we have seen no real improvement in the Patriot. The Patriot has never worked. This is not new.
Really?
It's new because people have been somehow, they see what they often see is the two interceptors that you're looking at now.
Yeah.
They at some point will explode, but we don't see that in this case. Oh, there they go. They both explode.
Yeah. Did they crash into each other?
They have warheads on them. The Patriot has a warhead.
Right.
And the warhead is a fragmentation warhead. Think of it as a shotgun.
Got it.
And so it tries to pass close enough to the incoming ballistic missile and explode the warhead and drive fragments from the warhead into the ballistic missile. Unfortunately, the crossing speed is so high that when the fragments, let's think of the fragments coming off perpendicular to the missile, they come in many directions.
Mm-hmm.
But when if I illustrate the speed, the fragments are moving slow relative to the crossing speed. So they have almost no chance of damaging the ballistic missile unless they hit it at the front, inadvertently hit it at the front. And we do see such intercepts occasionally.
But not as many as we would have expected. I have another one for you. I believe...
I would say the intercept rate is well below 4 or 5%. In other words, it's not close. It's not close to the numbers that they're telling us. Not close.
4 or 5% of the missiles that Iran is shooting are actually being intercepted? That's it?
Maybe.
Wow.
Incidentally, this is what you see in Ukraine against the Russian Iskander missile, which has also been completely defeating Patriots.
Which is why Russia's winning that war?
Well, it's not the only reason Russia's winning that war, but it's certainly a significant reason, because the Iskander can do a lot of damage, and the Russians have been using this missile with great effect.
Let's go to another video I have for you. This is also, I believe, my producers told me, a Patriot missile. You tell us if we're wrong, but let's watch it.
Yeah, okay. These are three Patriots. I happen to have this. You see, there's a second one that's coming up.
Yep.
And if you look carefully as these missiles turn over, you can see coming from the bottom, that's an incoming warhead.
Mm-hmm.
And third Patriot is now launched, and you see it cross the path.
Yes.
Completely missing it, and then the warhead going to ground.
This is not
atypical. So there are three interceptors, $4 million each, going against a missile that may cost $1 million, and all of them missing. And this is a quite common engagement when you get good video. This is a good video because you can see everything happening. Most videos, they're moving around, so it's hard to see everything that's happening. But again, this is a zero intercept for three firings. So we've seen five interceptors fired against two different targets and no hits in these two videos. And this is typical of what's going on.
But we were told these anti-ballistic missile systems that the United States has, I guess the THAAD and the Patriot, are supposed to be the most amazing things on this planet. And countries, I understand, like South Korea and Japan, have been spending buku bucks on these things. They got to be watching this and going, wait a minute, what the hell did we buy?
What's amazing is that the claims have been going on for 35 years. And people, you were criticizing the journalism in the United States.
Yeah.
I have been talking about this. I was talking about this in 1992 or three after the Gulf War of 91. And I had videos and I could show what was happening, just like you just did. And the press still went on to say, well, the intercept rate is high. I mean, this is not something that's new. What's new is you're looking at it and you're showing your audience, yeah. And we're looking at it, and your audience can judge for themselves.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing has been going on, and this is a gigantic fraud because tens of billions of dollars have been spent on Patriot systems just by the United States alone. We have spent $40 or $50 billion buying and deploying Patriots that can't do any kind of missile defense at all. Against aircraft, they're very effective. If you want to shoot down an airplane, my advice to any pilot who's flying an airplane that's fired upon by a Patriot is get out of the airplane. you will not survive. You just get out, just abandon the airplane.
Yeah.
But against ballistic missiles, forget it. No capability. And the reasons are simple. The ballistic missile is traveling at a tremendously high speed, in this case about over 3 kilometers per second. That means every thousandth of a second, every millisecond, this missile has moved 3 meters. So you can imagine how difficult it is to hit the right spot on this missile. And you must hit the right spot, because if you hit the body of the missile, the warhead will just break off and go onto the ground and explode. We've seen that numerous times. So this is a different target from an airplane.
That's an amazing explanation. I want to show you another video now. This is number 3, Gene. This is the clusters, I guess we're describing them as. Tell us what this is and what's the significance of this? I guess these are Iranian cluster missiles coming in?
Yeah, these are cluster munitions. They probably carry about 3 kilograms of explosives each.
Mm-hmm.
So they're equivalent. They have nearly the explosive power of an artillery rocket, which typically carries about 6 kilograms of explosives. So when these things come in, they're deployed from a vehicle. And you can see a brighter object in the middle of that. That has just deployed all these submunitions. And they're coming in, they travel at high speed because they have, if you look at the munition, it has wings that it deploys as soon as the canisters with the wings folded in. And as soon as they're thrown out, the wings deploy. So if it's tumbling, submunition is tumbling, it immediately orients itself so that it's flying like an arrow through air. And because it's oriented, the drag on it is very low. Aerodynamic drag is very, if they were tumbling, you'd see them slowing up behind the actual deployment system. But they're all oriented because of the wings that fold out. And they come to the ground and they hit like an artillery rocket. And, you know, they do significant damage.
How do you stop them?
How do you stop them? You can't stop them. There is no solution to this.
There is no there's no defense system.
The only way you can stop them is shelter. You can reduce against a munition of this type. You can increase your chances of surviving or not being injured by just going into one of these safe rooms that the Israelis have built into all their buildings. The bigger warheads are more problematic because the bigger warheads can knock down the whole building. Wow. And if the building gets knocked down, you're going to get crushed in the rubble. But if the smaller munitions, they'll come through the roof of the building and they'll explode. And if you're in a room where this happens, you're dead. I mean, it'll kill you without doubt. But if you're in a specialized room that's protected, there's a much greater chance you will not be injured or killed. So against this kind of munition, what I would call a passive defense has a good chance of working. Wow. But you do need to know that they're coming. And right now, the air defense system of the West, United States and Israel, has effectively already been destroyed. Iranians destroyed 4 THAAD radars. These are long-range ballistic missile radars. Each of them cost about $300 to $500 million each.
Yeah.
So we've lost four of those radars.
We have that. Hold on. I think we've got some pictures. Yeah. Gene, this is the surveillance and eavesdropping radars that were recently destroyed. We've got a picture of that. Go on, Professor. Right. You can talk while we look at these with our audience. There they are.
Yeah. Well, the big radar in Qatar that was destroyed is critical.
This one's in Erbil.
Because it can see the cluster of missiles that are launched from Iran.
That's Qatar, yes.
The THAAD radars do not have the ability to acquire incoming ballistic missiles unless they're told where to look. There's a successful destruction of a
radar.
That's
the one in Qatar that you were just speaking of, as a matter of fact, right?
Yes. But the what I was stunned by, I'll be honest with you, I expected this destruction to happen, but I didn't expect it to happen so completely and so soon. And for reasons I don't understand, there seems to be no significant air defense against these drones. The drones are hard to get. I mean, it's definitely, they fly in low, the radar is hard, it's very hard to see it. But these installations in the Persian Gulf seem to have essentially no working air defense right from the beginning.
Hmm.
Now they have no air defense because the radars have been destroyed. Without a radar, you can't do anything with air defense. I mean, your interceptors may as well be, you know, shot into the air, you know, for fireworks.
But these drones, these drones are just a piece of aluminum with wings and a bomb on it. I mean, it's totally primitive, right? I mean, this stuff is not very sophisticated. Well, how's that getting through?
You know, the Russians have a statement, best is the enemy of good enough. you know, you don't need to be sophisticated. You don't need to spend $1 million on a drone like the Americans do. And in fact, I think this war is actually the beginning of the end of American military dominance, because the Americans do not have the munitions to continue this war at the same intensity it's been going on. We, the Americans, but please don't assume that I'm supporting this.
Yeah.
We Americans do not have a lot of munitions. And, you know, we have, you know, for example, they have used 800 cruise missiles at this point, is according to some of the statements I've heard.
Yeah.
Now, we produce 80 cruise missiles a year. That's our production capacity. That's 10 years of cruise missile production. So we just used up 10 years of cruise missile production in a few days in the Persian Gulf against the Iranians. We cannot sustain this nonsense that's being stated by the Secretary of War Hegseth and the President Trump is total nonsense. This intensity of attack on Iran cannot be maintained for more than a couple of weeks, maybe.
Hmm.
And then it's going to be the Iranians firing back. And from what we have so far seen, they can fire back indefinitely. And they have made it clear that they will.
Indefinitely?
Before this war started.
You said indefinitely. That's a strong word, no?
Well, I think this is a war of attrition, and the war is going to be ended on the terms that Iran dictates.
The word indefinitely presumes that they're not going to run out of stuff. I mean, aren't they eventually? If we run out, aren't they going to run out? I mean, where are they getting
this
stuff?
Well, they have production facilities that are oriented toward maintaining their capacity to keep firing. The United States is a capitalist country, of course, as you know, and this preoccupation with private industry has destroyed the American ability to sustain a war of any length. Because when I'm a private manufacturer, in other words, I don't work for the government, I work for myself, mm-hmm. I work for my profits. And when I'm a private manufacturer, I build a facility that's just at the limit of what the contract I have from the government asks me for. Mm. I don't build it so it can be expanded. That's expensive. That takes away from my profit. So we have this profit-oriented military industry, which is bleeding the American taxpayer dry of funds, destroying our society because there's all kinds of medical and health needs and social needs that are not being properly funded, and it cannot produce at the level that is needed in a situation like this. And this is predictable. This was predictable. So
why didn't we know this? The things that you're saying, frankly, are amazing. I was looking forward to having you on, but the numbers that you're sharing with us and the explanations of why these missiles aren't working and the fact that you're telling us that you knew they weren't going to work before you watched them not work, this is all really eye-opening. And I'm frustrated as an American that I'm finding out now. I mean, what the hell?
Well, the United States is run by oligarchs. Americans like to point at Russia and say it's run by oligarchs. Putin took care of the oligarchs.
Yeah.
Putin did the right thing. He told the oligarchs, you can't do what you're doing because it's not in the national interest of Russia. You can't rape Russia. You can make a profit, but you cannot do it without restraint. Mm-hmm. So he put them in their place. So Russia is in much better shape than the United States is because we're run by oligarchs. And these people have no concern about the well-being of the United States. All they want is more for themselves. They have no social interest. They have no sense of social contract. All they want is more money. And we're now seeing the consequences of that in a very significant way. And our press, as you pointed out, also is run by oligarchs. And what the American system should be doing, we have the laws to do it, but you need people to enforce it. We should be breaking up all of the ownership of these big journalistic organizations and having them broken into many private organizations.
Like the old days.
So that organizations can be run by individuals who have a diversity of interests and views and biases, if you call it.
Yeah.
You no longer have that in the American press.
Like when I was growing up.
We don't get information.
Right. When I was growing up, there was a hometown newspaper and a hometown TV station and 10 hometown radio stations. And my hometown paper, proud to say, was the Miami Herald. Now the Miami Herald is one piece of his giant corporation with 100 newspapers all over the country or whatever it is, if it hasn't been already bought out.
The American press is now very close in terms of how it operates, of what it produces, to the Soviet press at the time of greatest repression and government control.
Yeah.
I mean, the press in Russia, from what I have seen of it, is much more free than the press in the United States.
I can vouch for
that. It may not be as free as some people would like it to be.
Yeah.
But it's nothing like the press in the United States. You have nothing like your show in the United States. We just don't have it. So
it's amazing.
And it's a real problem. You cannot have a democracy with all this nonsense about democracy and other countries are autocratic and this nonsense that's spouted on American media. We don't have a democracy. You can't have a democracy if you're intentionally misinforming the great bulk of the American people. You know, I know highly, I'm very lucky. As an accident of my life, and it is an accident of my life, my father was a welder, okay? I did not come out of a highly educated background. As an accident of my life, I now live among highly educated people. Yeah. It's just what happens to you when you inadvertently, without even thinking about it, become part of an academic intellectual community.
Yeah.
And I know all these highly educated people who are interested, and they don't know basic facts. And the reason they don't know basic facts is not because they're not interested, not because they're it's because they haven't understood until they're told, and I've told many of them, that there are other sources of news other than the mainstream press,
yeah.
because you can't read the New York Times and get accurate news. It's just, and the Washington Post is even worse.
You have to see this, and you go to my, go to YouTube and you'll find it, Professor. I was on a panel the other day on TRT, it's called, the Turkish television network. And I was on with a couple of guys, and they were both former U.S. ambassadors. And they said, we are completely sure right now that very few, if any, Iranian missiles are getting through. That's what they said.
Well,
on the air.
They don't know.
And I said to the guy, I said, where do you get your information? CNN? I mean, NBC? It's like, that's crazy what you just said. And he was convinced.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the ambassadors, I know a lot of older people,
yeah.
you know, ambassadors.
But these guys were former ambassadors. One was for, I can't remember, but they were former ambassadors on the show. State Department guys.
Yeah,
you know?
Because some of the more recent former ambassadors are, they're ridiculous, they're clowns. You know, we've had extraordinarily talented people be our ambassadors, but I think for the last 20 or 25 years, we have clowns taking over. So the people you meet who have the title of ambassador are rarely, if at all, truly trained properly, educated properly, and have a broad enough understanding of the world. They're people who are chosen for their political malleability and their willingness to make claims that they should know. If they don't know, they should know or false or not investigate what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, invite Chaz Freeman
yes.
on your, you will get an ambassador who's an extraordinarily well-educated man, astonishingly so. There still are Renaissance people available in the modern world, and a lot of them are these older ambassadors.
Yeah.
And we used to, the American system used to produce some extraordinary people. The Russian system still produces them. You look at a guy like Sergei Lavrov.
Yeah.
He's an amazing man. He knows history. He knows culture. When I say he knows culture, he knows American culture. He knows South American culture.
Yeah.
He knows Russian culture. You know, he's a broadly educated man. He understands the complexity of thinking in other nations. These people are clowns that we have. These are people, they're parrots for an ignorant, politically narrow administrations.
Let me show
and
you.
And I include Democratic candidates.
Oh, yeah.
Candidates
no, it has it has nothing to do with party affiliation. It has to do with who your donors are, really. But before we get off on a political discussion, I want to show you some more videos that we put together because we want to get an understanding of what's happening to the people who are affected by this war. This next video is shrapnel. And I've been seeing a lot of reports of shrapnel just falling out of the sky and killing people or causing a lot of damage in people's homes. Here's an example of it. Can you talk to this a little bit?
Well, what's happening is the Iranians are launching multiple types of missiles. There's a mix of older ballistic missiles and newer ones. The newer ones are better designed. They're better designed in the sense that the missile comes into the atmosphere, it bends over if, you know, or it deploys its warhead ahead of time. Now, the back end of this missile is heavy. You know, it doesn't have fuel in it. You know, the fuel has been expended. It's a rocket motor.
Yeah.
But now this thing can start tumbling. And if it tumbles, it can slow up to a very low speed, maybe 200 kilometers per hour.
Mm.
Not, you know, hundreds of meters per second, whereas they come in at 3,000 meters per second. So as they slow up, aerodynamic drag, but they're heavy and they're big. And when they hit the ground, they can hit the ground minutes later because they slow up at high, and they're falling at low speeds because the aerodynamic drag causes them to slow up. So in many engagements, when you're looking at the engagements, you will see warheads come in and explode. And then you'll see interceptors rising into the sky after the warhead has come in. And what they're doing, those missiles are shooting at debris. We saw this in the Gulf War of 91. The system is, these air defenses are highly automated, and the computer system recognizes that there's something in the air, and it's traveling at a speed compatible with an airplane. Airplanes are very dangerous. An airplane can carry 4, 5, 6 tons of munition. So they fire at them. And of course, they're not firing at an airplane. They're firing at debris. Mm. And this debris comes down. And if you're in the wrong place and get hit by it, it'll kill you. I actually have a video from earlier in this war where literally a man is killed. It was a camera, and you could see this big section of a missile happen to come down parallel to the ground, and it just hit the man and killed him.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that, I understand, going on in Tel Aviv that is not being reported because there's just so much action over the skies there. I don't know if you have anything to share on that.
I'm sorry, I missed.
On Tel Aviv, do you have any sense of what's happening there? Because the Israeli press
Tel Aviv is suffering enormous damage. It's enormous damage. I've only gotten bits and pieces of scenes on the ground. Those scenes show tremendous damage from single warheads. The warheads are powerful enough on the more advanced missiles, because it's a mix of missiles. The warheads are powerful enough that they're able to do severe damage to even concrete and steel reinforced buildings, which is what a lot of downtown Tel Aviv is. And the fact that these here you see that's a lot of debris.
That's Tel Aviv.
And here you have, of course, a tremendous number of independent rockets coming in. And let's see, this one is another example. I think I've seen this.
That's the other one. Hey, let me show you something else.
And when you see that flash on the horizon.
Yeah.
That may have been it. Anyway, I can't.
It's hard to tell what's up. But I want to move you to something else because I heard you talking about this. Was it with Glenn Deason or something the other day? I don't know. You were on with one of my colleagues the other day, and you mentioned this. It may have been Danny Davis. And you showed how these, apparently the Iranians have been able to hide their missiles deep underground in the desert. And when they come out of the ground, there's this smoke cloud that prevents people from being able to pinpoint where it is. We've got some of these. Watch this.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. Look, describe this to us. And why is that problematic for Americans trying to detect where that came from?
That missile is coming out of a hole in a tunnel. It's a tunnel. There's no way of knowing which way that tunnel goes. The tunnel may be going between those two launches we just saw. We don't know. The Iranians have built underground tunnels crisscrossing areas where they have missiles deployed. At the top of each, at chosen locations, they have a hole in the tunnel to the surface. But the hole to the surface has a very light roof on top of it, very lightweight roof, and sand on top of that roof. So if you were to look at this frame by frame, what you would first see, and I've examined this, what you first see is a bright flash of brilliant light pushing its way through the top of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see that bright flash of light rise up and then all of a sudden bloom out. And that's the rocket exhaust, because the rocket has now moved through the tunnel. In other words, it punches its way through this roof, which is not hard to do. This is typical launch procedures for many kinds of rockets. And then as it rises up, the plume is creating all this exhaust, which of course causes all this sand to be lifted into the air. And so there's no way of finding the tunnel before the launch. So these tunnels can be made at any location along the tunnel. Since you don't know where the tunnel is going, there can be launches from anywhere.
So usually in the past, they would see the launcher because it would be above ground. The fact that the launcher is below ground makes it difficult for someone to then locate where the hell that missile came from, is what you're saying.
Well, what was often the case is people, including the Iranians initially, they put their missiles into underground silos. It's a silo in the ground. Mm. And the silo, you can see the top of the silo, so you can go after it. But if you have a tunnel and you can put a hole in the tunnel at different places and you can cover those holes with sand, you can't find where the launch points are. Mm. And the adversary can have tremendous number of launch points because the tunnels are very long. They're probably tens of kilometers in length or more. So, and they're probably side tunnels. So you could have a, and once you do a launch from a hole, you may not come back to it again for a long time, but you can still come back to it because you can cover it again, put sand over it. Now, the adversary knows that there's where the tunnel is because, you know, we can keep track of these things from once there's been a launch, but you don't know whether there's a missile in it or not. Are you going to expend ammunition on what it may be an empty tunnel?
Shooting into the desert.
So you can keep very large numbers of decoy tunnels, and just continue launching. Yeah. And it's all underground, and you know there's nothing. You know, these statements about we're destroying all these launches. Let's wait and see.
Yeah.
My expectation is we are not destroying launchers. We are destroying some launchers, but very few. And if it's a repeat of past wars, we will have destroyed almost nothing relative to the total numbers available to the adversary.
Let me show you one more thing. These are U.S. bases that have been hit. I don't know what the numbers are, but it's an extraordinary number comparative to what the expectation was. U.S. installations, U.S. bases, and any of these Persian Gulf countries that exist that are being somewhat devastated in some cases by the Iranians. Yes. What the hell is going on with that? I thought these places were going to be protected.
Iran has already, I want to underscore, this is a surprise to me, to be clear, has already taken out all of the radar systems that are needed not for air defense. In fact, there are no radars that can be used for air defense except at the very end of location. In other words, the THAAD missile defense system can't operate because it doesn't have radars. The Arrow is very limited. David Sling is, because the radars cannot acquire warheads at far enough range to allow time for the interceptors to fly out and make intercepts.
I see.
So in Tel Aviv now, they are getting 1 minute or less warning of an attack. In other words, this is warning. This is not air defense. And I can tell you off the top of my head, when I heard this, I said, that's about 200 kilometers range. Because you can see for about 200 kilometers with maybe an Arrow radar that's still operating. And those radars are barely acquiring the incoming objects probably not with enough time to launch interceptors and do tracking, but they're probably enough time to give 1 minute or 2 minute, not 2 minutes, 1 minute of warning. And what we're hearing is that sometimes there's no warning. Sometimes there are explosions going on and there's no warning at all. So Iran has already destroyed the early warning system, and before that, the air defense system itself. Wow. Now, does this make a difference? No, because the interceptors were not succeeding in destroying the incoming warheads. So in terms of mitigating damage from the interceptors, it makes almost no difference. But in terms of warning, it does make a difference, because if you have a couple of minutes of warning, you know, you can go down to a basement. So if the building gets hit and collapses, you're in a reinforced structure that where you can probably survive. Mm. If you go into a safe room because you don't have time to get out of the building and go into it, and that building goes down, you have a high chance of being killed. And so so the loss of warning time is critical, is very important. And it's going to take a big toll psychologically on the occupants of these cities that are going to remain under attack for months if the Iranians have the wherewithal to continue firing these ballistic missiles, and incidentally drones now too.
Yeah,
because the drones will not be intercepted, because if you have no air defense, the drones can come in.
I just heard an admiral say just today, I was following this, and they were talking about U.S. putting minesweepers in the Gulf, and the admiral say the problem is we used to use minesweepers and they were very effective, but we've never used minesweepers in an environment or a theater that has drones. And what those drones could do to those minesweepers and those ships in the Gulf might be a challenge we've never seen before. He's probably right.
Any American military officer who would order minesweepers into the Strait of Hormuz should be removed from his position.
Why?
Because he is recklessly endangering his forces. Because this would not be a militarily innovative action that might or might not succeed. In other words, a maneuver in war that might or might not work out for your benefit. This would be sending your people to be killed.
Good God.
This would not be, for no reason, because they couldn't perform the operation of taking mines out. Those ships will be lost along with their crews.
It's not a pretty picture. You are so good at taking people through what I call the X's and O's of war. You know, it's easy to sit on the sidelines and talk about the politics, and he said this and that said that, and we're going to kill them and they're doing this. But to actually be able to show what the hardware is, what it does, what its efficiencies are, and what it's good at is something that you're good at. And I just want to tell you how much we appreciate you having on the show and taking us through this explanation.
I'm sorry that I have to be here for these discussions, but I'm glad I can help.
Well, thank you.
I'm committed. I'm committed to helping the public understand, public, not just Americans.
Thank you, Professor, because I think they need to understand what the consequences of war actually are, and you're so good at being able to explain those by giving us those X's and O's. Thank you again, Professor.
Thank you
Theodore
for having
Postol.
Me.
God bless. Thank you very much. Well,
bye-bye.
Check out the page that we have on everywhere, I guess, nowadays. We used to be happy just to be on YouTube, but lately we've kind of been exploding and we're all over the place, and thank God we're having a lot of success reaching a lot of people. Like, we're up to about 20 million people a week now who are checking in with us all over the place. We're on BitChute, we're on YouTube, we're on X, we're on Spotify, and probably more to come. Most importantly, you're kind enough to let us into your homes. Thank you. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll look for you again soon.